from KQED.
And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Well, since Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, policies to help the poor have focused on cities. But a new report from the Brookings Institution finds that poverty in the suburbs grew 64% between 2000 and 2010. So the number of poor people living in suburbs now surpasses those living in cities or rural areas. In the Bay Area, for example, poverty in places like Antioch and Brentwood in Contra Costa County exploded in the past decade, growing much faster than in urban places like San Francisco or Oakland. Joining us now to talk about the trend and what to do about it, Elizabeth Kneebone. She's a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings and co-author of Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. She joins us by phone from Washington. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And joining us also, Alisa Friedman, Executive Director of Opportunity Junction. That's an Antioch-based nonprofit that runs a job training and placement program to help East Contra Costa County residents become self-sufficient. Welcome to you as well. Let me begin with you, Elizabeth Kneebone. Give us a little bit more detail about this report. I mentioned East Contra Costa County, and that is where the report begins. Why there? What is it about that part of the Bay Area that is such a good example of this trend?
Well, we've thought this was a telling story to begin our book with, because it's really representative of trends that have been affecting regions across the country. The suburbs around the Bay Area, particularly in Contra Costa County, have seen rapid increases in poverty in recent years. That's both because new residents and families are moving into these communities, and also because of economic factors like the recession or structural changes in the economy that have seen longer-term residents hit hard the past decade and slip down the economic ladder.
Give us an example or two of things that have happened in those parts of the country that have made poverty worse there.
Well, I mean, one reason we see poverty growing in communities like Contra Costa County and suburbs, you know, across the country is often jobs are moving to suburban communities. Almost every major metro area has seen jobs decentralize over time, and people are following those opportunities. It's also looking for affordable housing, where either aging housing stock or newer housing stock may be affordable, or where people can use portable subsidies to find affordable housing, particularly in markets where city housing has become so expensive and you may need to move further in the region to find an affordable place. As I said, also seen economic changes over the decades, like the faster growth in lower-paying jobs. And again, many of those jobs are in suburbs, in construction, hospitality services.
And so these are working poor.
Right. Many of the families that we're talking about are working and may have been hit by unemployment with the Great Recession and the fallout of the collapse of the housing market. But even as they're coming back to work, they may not be making as much as they did before and still struggling to get by.
And East Contra Costa County, I mean, that's also an area, Antioch, Brentwood, Pittsburgh, that was really particularly hard hit. And I'll ask Lisa Friedman about this, but by the foreclosure crisis, wasn't it?
That's right. You know, you had a lot of jobs when the market was still booming in the earlier part of the decade in construction and opportunities that could draw families there and employment for local residents. As soon as the housing market collapsed and so much of the foreclosure crisis was really concentrated in suburban communities, more than three-quarters of foreclosures in our major metro areas happened in suburbs, and that's particularly true in Contra Costa County. So then you have people who are now unemployed and have been struggling in the years following that market downturn.
And what's the safety net like in a place like Contra Costa County or other suburban counties?
That's one of the challenges that so many suburban communities and residents are facing as poverty has been growing in these places, is that often the safety net is spread much thinner. It's much patchier. I mean, these communities often haven't evolved the same kinds of infrastructure and capacity, whether in the local municipalities or in the nonprofit sector, that many cities have spent decades building up in order to address the needs of a poor population. And often these places are not well served by transit, so it can be really difficult to access the kinds of services that can help families get by when they're struggling with unemployment or trying to make ends meet.
And Elizabeth Kneebone, how do the demographics of the suburban poor differ from people living in inner cities?
In many ways, the city and suburban poor across our major metro areas resemble one another in terms of work effort and education levels, in terms of BA, bachelor's attainment, and in fact, in terms of the number living in deep poverty, below 50% of the federal poverty line, very similar shares in both cities and suburbs. Where we do see some differences are in racial and ethnic makeup. The suburban poor tend to be more white than in urban neighborhoods, although people of color in suburbs also still tend to be disproportionately poor in suburbs.
And when you're poor in and you live in a city like San Francisco or Oakland, there are soup kitchens, there are services if you're addicted to drugs or if you're homeless and so on. Is that just not the case, Elisa Friedman, in a place like Contra Costa County?
Well, Contra Costa is a pretty broad designation. So you've got East County, and you've got Richmond, which is a little bit more concentrated. But the services are still there, but they're harder to access because of the transportation problems. So there might be a soup kitchen, but it might take a long time to get there.
And might they also, and this is anecdotal, but, you know, might they just, I've heard of a lot of people from Contra Costa County, for example, showing up at free medical clinics in Oakland or other parts of Alameda County, which maybe have a richer safety net. Have you heard that as well?
You know, I haven't heard that, but it makes sense because in terms of accessibility, a BART ride from Bay Point might get you into Oakland for one of those services, whereas getting to the county medical facility in Martinez might actually be more difficult.
Yeah. And Elizabeth Kneebone, is this based on census data or are there other things that you brought into this?
We drew a lot from census data in putting together the research for the book, particularly in terms of the poverty trends themselves and the demographics of communities facing these trends. But we were also able to supplement that data with other information, like from the Department of Housing and Urban Development in terms of the use of housing choice vouchers, as well as Bureau of Labor Statistics data and other sources to give us a picture of the broader trends that intersect with poverty and what's shaping those trends.
Yeah. And what about, and maybe you didn't get into this, but, you know, as you go, the further you get away from cities, the more likely you are to find, you know, either conservative Democrats or maybe Republicans who are in representing those folks in their state legislature or in Congress. Do you find or, you know, have you thought at all about, as you put this report together, the receptivity to the elected officials in these places to the kinds of programs that might help these folks?
You know, that really varies from place to place. And that was, you know, what we found in the years that we've been working on this and being able to spend time in different regions across the country talking to local elected officials. In the first place, there's often, you know, though these trends have happened rapidly, and particularly in recent years, our perceptions haven't really kept up, both in terms of just the general public and our understanding of where poverty is and who it affects, but also among local leaders, even funders and providers. It's not always consistent in the way we think today about where poverty is and how does that match up with the reality. So we've seen a range of responses from different elected officials in suburbs across the regions we've visited, some who've really seen these changes happening and are trying to get on top of it, be proactive, think about how do we better serve our residents and connect them to opportunities in the region, to other places that just haven't quite grasped that these trends are happening. And then, yes, you do run into elected officials who may be resistant. They may see these changes happening but don't want to take the steps to create services or to directly address these issues because they're concerned about whether or not that would draw additional residents into their communities or how that might change their municipalities.
And Elisa Friedman, what would you add to that?
I'd say that our representatives in East County and in Contra Costa generally are very supportive of bringing safety net services and job training services here, but the national trend has been to defund government support for these kinds of programs, and that's happening right at a time when those in suburban poverty most need those services to get them back trained and into the job market, into career paths that will lead to self-sufficiency. So I think that's a big problem.
Talking about the rise in suburban poverty, as shown in a new report by Brookings, our guest this half hour, Elizabeth Kneebone. She is the co-author of Confronting Suburban Poverty in America, and also Elisa Friedman. She is executive director of Opportunity Junction, which is based in Antioch over in the East Bay. If you want to join us this this hour, the number to call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to forum@kqed.org or leave a comment on our Facebook page as well. To what extent do you think that the kinds of programs, and I'll address this to Elizabeth first, the kinds of programs the U.S. has relied on for poverty in the inner cities, to what extent, A, are those working, and B, you know, would they work for this suburban group of poor?
We've built up a number of different policies and programs to address poverty in place, you know, to address the needs of poor and in poor communities over the last several decades. But that system that we've built, for one, it was really designed with inner city distressed neighborhoods in mind. And that system is fragmented across more than 80 different programs, 10 different agencies. So we have $82 billion that the federal government directs to addressing poverty in place, but it's a system that's difficult even for cities to navigate, and not one that's really well suited or easily adapted to address the needs of suburban poverty, partly because the map of poverty in suburbs can look very different than when you're dealing with a very concentrated neighborhood in the inner city. And also because many of these programs were designed to go to municipalities or certain jurisdictions and don't often work flexibly to work across community lines and serve the broader scope of places that are struggling with these challenges.
And Elisa Friedman, what would you add to that based on your experience in Antioch and in the area there?
Well, yeah, we actually have our main office in Antioch, but we also have a group working out of Bay Point, which is a very distressed community where the poverty rate's doubled in the past 20 years. And we serve people from Brentwood and Oakley and Pittsburgh and do have to work with a number of different municipalities in terms of channeling some funding streams to try to support the programs that we have for folks from these different jurisdictions. So, yeah, it's definitely not a program designed for the suburban landscape.
Yeah, and what would it take to make it work for the suburban landscape, or does it? Do you need really a whole new model?
It's a really good question.
Sorry, I think there are really great models already evolving in communities across the country. You know, these are difficult issues, and working across jurisdictional lines, working across program lines is complicated. But I think that we look to people who are figuring out ways to do that, and they help point the directions that we need to take in terms of reshaping the current system we have to work better region-wide across city and suburban lines. So it's, you know, things like you could look to the Chicago suburbs where municipalities got together in the wake of the foreclosure crisis, rather than wanting to compete against one another and really not having the capacity or resources to deal with these issues on their own. You had 19 jurisdictions on the south side of Chicago, 5 on the west side, and Chicago's quite a fragmented region. So you saw these areas coming together to work collaboratively. Now, when they first applied for federal funds, that didn't necessarily go smoothly, you know, because the federal government isn't used to dealing with these types of collaborative structures and this kind of suburban landscape. But they've been able to navigate that and now clear the way for, you know, there are a lot of federal funding streams that can be used that way. It's just nobody's really done it that much before.
And Elisa Friedman, to what extent are people in the Bay Area working more across county lines?
There actually is a regional prosperity initiative that's looking at fighting poverty throughout the Bay Area counties, and I think one of the focuses on that is sort of the transportation and trying to make the different services available or the different jobs available, something that people can access from different areas. But that is a federally funded, I think, through HUD initiative, and it is focusing regionally.
Yeah. We've got a comment from a listener on our website who writes, I'd love to hear some discussion on West Contra Costa County, where I live, which contains some of the wealthiest zip codes in the country, according to Forbes. What role do wealthy zip codes or towns like Danville, San Ramon, Orinda, Lafayette, and Moraga play? Elisa Friedman, any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, some of the funding streams through the government do come through the county, and so the county does look to fund in the areas that need those services. So there's a way in which those communities are contributing to the solution by being a part of the larger county. And we find that there's a lot of generosity from people in Lafayette and Walnut Creek and Danville just to support, you know, at a basic level, the nonprofits that are doing the work in the areas that need the services. So I think there's a role for volunteers and for donations and general support.
And Elizabeth Niebone, I mean, there is an irony, I guess that's the word. I mean, here we are in the Bay Area, which does have some of the wealthiest zip codes. I mean, Silicon Valley, my goodness, Atherton, Menlo Park. And yet you see in your report that poverty has grown very quickly in places like the San Jose metro area.
That's right. This is really a trend that's touching all kinds of communities and all types of suburbs, even the places you just mentioned, like Danville or San Ramon. The poverty rates are still lower there, but they experience quite rapid increases in their poor population. So this is something that it may be more hidden there, or we don't expect to see it in these kinds of communities. But it's something that's really reaching throughout metropolitan areas, and if anything, underscoring what a shared challenge this is across regions.
I would think it might be just psychologically more difficult to be poor in a suburban area where there is also so much visible wealth. Any thoughts about that, Elizabeth? I mean, it's not easy to be poor anywhere, but
no, that's right.
You know, where you've got this contrast, and it's easy. I think maybe easier to overlook the poverty.
I think that's right. It's not easy to be poor anywhere, but I do think in some of these communities in the suburbs, it can be more hidden. And we've seen, especially with the rapid rises in recent years following the recession, in talking to providers who work with this growing low-income population and many people who'd never had connections to the safety net before, you know, people may not know what services are available to them or may not want to reach out to use those services because this is a new experience for them, and having to turn to a service provider or to the county for help can be difficult. And in fact, they may even wait longer and have even more needs because they've tried to exhaust every other option before connecting to those kinds of services.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Tom is on the line in Martinez. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for the program. I just wanted to make the comment, and I'm sure your panelists are probably aware, that there is universal health care coverage essentially for the poor of Contra Costa County through the county health care system called the Basic Adult Care. And of course, there's always going to be problems with access to these services, but if you do meet the financial criteria, you can get coverages, regular office visits, and access to specialty services. I'm sure your panelists can comment more on that. Thank you.
Yeah. Elisa?
Yeah, absolutely. Adult basic care is accessible to people based on their income, and exactly what the caller identified as the problem is the transportation and getting to the services that are available.
And Elizabeth Niebone, I mean, there is a connection too between health or medical crisis and poverty. I mean, sometimes that's one of the leading causes of bankruptcy and personal poverty is losing a job and not having health care covered, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, it's very connected to health and health insurance and the cost of health care. We see a lot of people who may be getting by, making ends meet, but often don't have a lot of savings or a kind of buffer for if a crisis strikes, and particularly if they don't have adequate coverage or are dealing with these quite burdensome health care costs, that can really set off a number of other challenges in their lives. And it's also an issue of if you're not able to work, how do you make ends meet, and what is your what's your path going forward if you're dealing with a disability or other long-term health problems?
And we're maybe getting a little far afield, but is there a hope at least that Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act is going to address some of those things?
I think that there is real potential with the Affordable Care Act to connect the discussion around health and health outcomes to the social determinants of health, what we call the social determinants of health, which include things like income, what kind of community are you in, and what can really, all these things intersect in so many ways. So it's an ability to bring a new lens and a new perspective to this. So we're really dealing with the holistic person and families within their communities.
Here's a comment from a listener who writes, oh, the irony of the segment on a $1.1 billion acquisition of internet nothingness, followed by a segment on the growing poverty rate. Gosh, we really are the worst of the primates, aren't we? Elizabeth Niebuhr, what do you want to be the takeaway from this?
For one, it's really updating our perceptions. That's the first step. Understanding the reach of poverty today, how that's changed, where and who it's affecting, so that we can more effectively address it. And I do think that there are concrete near-term steps we can take with the system that we have in place today to better serve communities across regions. But we really have to take that action, because this is a rapid rising trend. And so there should be some urgency in really rethinking how we address poverty and try to connect people to economic opportunity across regions so they're on a more stable economic footing.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking to Elizabeth Niebuhr, a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings and co-author of Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. And also joining us this hour, Elisa Friedman. She's executive director of Opportunity Junction. They're an Antioch-based nonprofit that helps job training and placement for folks living in the East County, helping them become self-sufficient. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. Again, I'm Scott Schaefer in this week for Michael Krasny. Lisa Friedman, what are you hoping comes out of this in terms of action or policy discussions?
I think there are a couple of things. One is taking a lens on how we address poverty in suburban areas and how that's different. The book is going to highlight that. And again, it's things like transportation issues, different kinds of housing issues, the lack of availability of jobs close to where people work in many cases, or well-paying jobs. But the other piece is, and this has been focused on in a paper that was published through the Federal Reserve Board here in San Francisco, is just the awareness that there is poverty in the suburbs, that the service providers in those areas are underfunded. In East County, for every $1 of social services available to a poor person in East County, there are $8 of social services available to a poor person living in Richmond. And that's a function of the fact that poverty has been relatively invisible out here, and we need a greater investment in the services that will provide a safety net for people while they're in poverty, and that will help people exit poverty through training and employment.
All right, let's try to get another call or two in here. Let's go to Brandon in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is really, I mean, everything I just heard about the solutions, transportation and better paying jobs, I just find that all that is incongruous with capitalism. Frankly, capitalism doesn't care. I just read an article 15 minutes ago about how Apple is keeping billions of dollars offshore. It's strategically best for them to not pay taxes and do all the shenanigans they are to avoid, you know, tax revenue, which would be able to fund the programs that this show is about. So what we really need to go, and I'm talking to everybody here, we really need to stop equating legal with right. And fundamentally, as long as everybody says, well, legally I could do that, and defends, inhumane actions, when I have these kind of discussions with people, people will get aggressive, and just it's so entrenched that legal is right. And frankly, as long as people get theirs, they don't care about other people. So that's my sad comment. But I think ultimately we're going to have to get to the point where interest rates rise and the Fed, not having an escape policy for their current printing. Once that's really clear and the consequences befall us, we'll really start to really rethink this whole system.
All right, Brandon. That's all I got to say. All right, thanks very much for the call, Elizabeth Niebuhr. To what extent do you think that the problems laid out here are really for government to address, whether it's federal, state, or local, or nonprofits like Elisa's?
I think, you know, today, really, the scale of the challenge and...
And by the way, sort of coming off of Brendan's point, there's also a role for companies and for the for-profit sector.
Absolutely. And as I was saying, the scale of the challenge today, region-wide, touching more people and places, and we know that the resources are not going to get any bigger anytime soon. In fact, in many ways, they've been shrinking. So it's going to have to actually be a shared collaborative approach to this. So it's not just government at the federal or local level. We need to have government entities working with the nonprofit sector and with the private sector in ways that we can leverage limited resources and make them stretch further. And again, I think there are a lot of good models that are evolving, and we highlight in the book some of these to work in this collaborative way. And because it is something, building off of Brandon's point, that, you know, this is something that affects us all, and we should think about this in terms of human capital. If we want healthy, you know, robust regions, part of that is making sure we're taking the residents of those places and training them, getting them prepared and skilled up to take jobs that make everybody better off in the end of the day.
And Elisa Friedman, the recession, of course, was very deep, probably the worst since the Great Depression. We're still climbing out of that. Most people seem to feel the economy is recovering. The unemployment rate is going down. To what extent do you think that the current path we're on in terms of the economic recovery is going to resolve some of these problems?
Well, certainly on the ground, we're seeing increased placements and higher wage rates, which is great, starting from, you know, what was a very, very difficult employment market. I think it's a very fragile recovery, and I think that we are actually seeing the effects of the sequester in terms of our funding, and I think it's, you know, there may be some repercussions down the line in terms of the economy as a whole and the contraction from there being fewer funds available to not only support people who need it and who will spend that money, and there'll be a multiplier effect, but also organizations that are helping them leverage their personal assets, their human ability to produce value.
And just quickly, we're just about out of time, but Elisabeth, what would you add to that?
Just, I think that the sequester is a good example of not being thoughtful about the way that we address our budget issues or cut back on some programs, and we have an opportunity now to sort of rethink how we approach this funding in these programs, and we could be much more thoughtful and make these dollars work more effectively.
All right. Thanks so much to both of you, Elisabeth Niebone from Brookings and Elisa Friedman from Opportunity Junction. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Susan Britton. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.